Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Greenville Daily Reflector, from the Washington Post, from Religion News Service, and more. This broadcast and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the Greenville Daily Reflector in Eastern North Carolina. And this is dated August 13th. And the title of this article is Efforts Deliver Aid and Comfort in Bertie County. This is by Deborah Griffin of the Daily Reflector, Dateline Windsor, North Carolina. Volunteers in neon orange and blaze yellow t-shirts dotted the ransacked landscape in Bertie County like beacons of hope in a community devastated by an EF3 tornado. They started coming just hours after the August 4th tornado splintered trees, obliterated homes, killed two, and injured at least 25 during Hurricane Isaias. Traveling from Greenville, across the state, and elsewhere, they worked through the weekend and have continued this week to deliver aid and comfort to more than 500 people officials said have been affected by the storm. "We love helping people," said Susan Van Noy of North Wilkesboro, a volunteer with Samaritan's Purse U.S. Disaster Relief. In Windsor, Samaritan's Purse volunteers are helping with tree removal, tarping roofs, and in any other way they're needed. "This is what God has called us to do," she said. "My husband was a minister for many years. We felt the Lord was calling us to do disaster relief." Bertie County officials said multiple volunteer organizations have moved in quickly to distribute supplies, clean up debris, cook meals, tarp roofs, and mud out houses. They estimate between 500 and 700 people are in need of aid. The twister completely destroyed 26 homes, left 8 unsafe for occupancy, and damaged over 200 in the early morning hours along a 10-mile stretch in southern Bertie County, particularly on Morning and Woodard roads. The damage estimate is less severe than earlier reports that indicated 200 homes were uninhabitable, but dwellings and lives still were turned inside out within minutes. On Saturday, personal belongings, evidence of happier times, remained scattered haphazardly among smashed vehicles, busted home appliances, twisted metal, and soggy insulation. A toddler's bright red bicycle, its training wheels mangled, was embedded 25 feet up in a tree twisted with electrical lines, metal siding, and roofing material. The brightly colored t-shirts helped identify many of the volunteers who came to help. Samaritan's Purse wore orange, and North Carolina Baptists on Mission wore yellow. COVID-19 complicated how organizations bring in teams to work. Samaritan's Purse usually draws volunteers from all over the United States to help in times of crisis. For this recovery, they're currently relying on day volunteers, those who live within just a few hours' drive. According to Van Noy, the organization is unable to house large groups overnight due to restrictions to help slow the coronavirus. She and her husband Tom are site team leaders, she said. They left for Windsor immediately when they received the call for storm recovery. They are among a few volunteer leaders being housed at Ross Baptist Church in Windsor. Howard Carter, a site team leader with Samaritan's Purse from Tennessee, was with them. "Normally I get a group of people I work with for several days, but they're trying to make sure everyone is safe. The amazing thing is the volunteers come. Instead of relying on people coming in from halfway across the United States and staying for a week, we're dealing with people who come just day to day," he said. Saturday he led volunteers from Chapel Hill, Askewville, and Pittsboro, and his group included a college student, a doctor, a postal service worker, and a pastor. North Carolina Baptists on Mission is providing hot meals twice a day drive-through style at the county's point of distribution site, Cedar Landing Baptist Church, at least through Friday. The group also has disaster recovery teams on the ground, helping with tree removal and cleanup. The organization also is relying on day volunteers from counties close to the disaster site. Other groups assisting victims in Windsor are the Red Cross, Team Rubicon, United Methodist Men, and the Civil Air Patrol. The CAP-NC wing helped distribute bottled water and MREs, ready-to-eat meals, and other supplies for families at Cedar Landing, which is the county's point of distribution. On Morning Road, Thelma Tate suffered substantial damage to her home and property. Samaritan's Purse helped clean up her yard Saturday and tarp her roof. "This meant so much to me," the 80-year-old said. "This meant my life. It means I don't have to kill myself picking up and moving all this stuff alone." Farther up the road, Lockwood Craig Jr.'s home was in pieces, no longer inhabitable. On Saturday, orange-shirted helpers from Samaritan's Purse worked to clear his yard of downed trees and debris. "I lost everything I got," he said. "Three vehicles, everything. But God saved my soul." Craig said he was asleep when the storm came. His phone alerted him to the tornado. Then he heard what others have described as the sound of a train coming. He crawled through his hallway while debris fell around him as the roof was caving in, escaping by ladder through a window. "I thought I was going on home," he said. "I ain't lying. I was scared to death." He then crawled along the ground to his neighbor's house through the storm, avoiding downed electrical lines. "I was used to crawling. I was in Vietnam, and you had to crawl," he said. He and his neighbor drove to a hotel for the night. "I know it was God who saved me," he said. In Greenville, organizations collected supplies for victims during an impromptu emergency donation on Friday outside the Walmart on Greenville Boulevard. The Reverend Rodney Coles of Interfaith Clergy and Paul Dunn of NC Volunteer Organizations active in a disaster headed up the effort. Two men in a truck donated a truck. Dunn said he was currently working on rescue efforts in eight counties across North and South Carolina affected by Isaias. "We're exhausted, but this really lifts your spirits. This is not just Pitt County showing love to Bertie. This is lifting our spirits, too," he said. Several Walmart employees donated money and items paid for with their own money. Others went back into the store and bought items to donate when they saw the collection effort. The Bertie County Morning Road Tornado Relief Fund has raised over $24,000 in less than 7 days, according to the Bertie County government website. The first disbursement went out Wednesday. "We know this money is desperately needed right now by these families to cover food, temporary housing, and other personal assistance for themselves and their families. These are trying times, and this is hopefully the first of many rounds of relief that we can provide to our citizens most impacted," said County Manager Juan Vaughn II. We'll turn next to an article from Religion News Service dated August 12th, and the title of this article is "Church Conflict During COVID-19 Growing Worry for Pastors, Says Lifeway Research." This is by Adele M. Banks of Religion News Service. Church conflict is a growing pressure point for pastors during the coronavirus pandemic, a new report shows. The report, based on a July survey by Lifeway Research, found that 27% of evangelical and mainline pastors cited maintaining unity and addressing conflict and complaints when asked about the pressure points they are feeling most. Just 8% cited disagreement and conflict as issues in an April survey, according to the research firm based in Nashville, Tennessee. The findings appear to be a barometer of the division in the country over the best ways to respond to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. "Shutting everything down was a whole lot less complicated than the debates over how to reopen," said Trevin Wax, a senior vice president at Lifeway Christian Resources, an arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. "There's a sense in which the pastor, in trying to care for the congregation, feels beat up right now." Wax, a former pastor, said the divides are different from what he saw as a congregation leader. In the past, he said, he saw people of different political parties serving together on the same deacon board because of their greater agreement on gospel issues. "There are people that are shocked and appalled to find out that there are other people in their congregation that have completely different views of the best way to handle a pandemic," he said. Hundreds of pastors responding to the survey included written responses to open-ended questions about the challenges they are currently facing. "My people are in very different places regarding the virus," wrote one pastor. "Some are losing patience and want to get on with normal life, with little regard for the potential consequences. Others are still practicing extreme social distancing and are having a tough time understanding others who are not taking this as seriously as they are." The second most cited pressure point was pastoring at a distance, with 17% mentioning it. 13% cited safety and well-being of their members, and 12% mentioned personal exhaustion and isolation. One pastor referred to the companions of Moses, who were described in the Bible's books of Exodus as helping him through a crisis. "Feeling disconnected from the people and their needs. Need encouragement, Aaron and Hur, to hold up my hands, people to come alongside me. But I am tired of virtual everything. P.S. Maybe I just need a hug." Wax said it has been discouraging to read some of the responses from the pastors who are both exhausted and struggling to keep their congregants together. "Good pastors feel responsible for maintaining the unity of the church," he said. "It's heartbreaking to read these comments from pastors who feel like a lot of that work that they've done in preserving the unity of the church feels threatened right now over differences that are really a matter of wisdom and judgment and discernment." The findings are based on online responses from 443 evangelical and mainline Protestant pastors surveyed online between July 20th and 22nd. The survey's overall margin of error is plus or minus 5 percentage points. We'll move to an article from the news from the Associated Press, based on a story from the Charlotte Observer, and this is based around the earthquake that struck western North Carolina a couple weeks ago. And the headline of the story is "Apt Bible Passage at Catholic Mass Coincides with Earthquake." Dateline Charlotte, North Carolina. The scripture quite literally came to life for several Catholic churches in North Carolina as a rare earthquake rattled portions of the state over the weekend. According to a news release from the Diocese of Charlotte, Father Richard Sutter of St. Gabriel's Catholic Church said the lector in the Sunday service had just reached the 19th chapter of 1 Kings, a Bible passage referring to the prophet Elijah, which said, "After the wind there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. It was then that parishioners felt the 5.1 magnitude earthquake centered near Sparta, the most powerful to hit the state in more than 100 years." Monitors said the 5.1 magnitude trembler struck at 8:07 a.m., following a much smaller quake several hours earlier. There were no reports of serious injuries, but some minor structural damage was reported in Sparta, as well as cracks in roads. Images on social media also showed items knocked off grocery store shelves. The Charlotte Observer reported that while he didn't feel it himself, Sutter said parishioners came up to him as soon as the service ended. He said the moment can be a lesson for the times. When there's fear from an earthquake, when there's fear from a storm, when there's fear from a pandemic and uncertainty, you have to let the Lord speak to us the truth, he said. Let's keep our eyes on Jesus Christ and not the waves or even earthquakes we cannot control, he said. Father Corey Catron, pastor of the Catholic Mission in Sparta, said his church suffered no apparent damage from the quake. Made for good homily material, though, the news release said. In his homily, Catron joked about being worried the next thing would be fire. He called the events a reminder of God's presence, adding, "We must not be distracted by the noise and problems of the world around us, but listen for his voice in the stillness." As the 11:15 a.m. Mass in Sparta was ending and Catron offered a final blessing, there was a 1.8 magnitude aftershock. He said the ceiling creaked for like 3 seconds, and everybody kind of looked up, and immediately, we knew what it was. We'll head now to the Washington Post and an article from August 11th by Michelle Borstein. And the title of this article, "Disgraced West Virginia Bishop Michael Bransfield was told a year ago to make restitution. His successor says Bransfield has gone incommunicado." More than a year after Pope Francis ordered ousted West Virginia Bishop Michael Bransfield to make personal amends for alleged sexual and financial misconduct, his successor bishop says he has yet to hear from Bransfield about a restitution proposal. Last Tuesday, Metro News, a West Virginia news site, quoted Bishop Mark Brennan as saying that he had not heard from Bransfield in many months, and I would not expect to. Whatever he is doing, and is in a dark hole. We do not know exactly what he is up to. We have not been in communication. In July 2019, Francis forbade Bransfield, a well-connected Philadelphian who had held prominent national spots in the Catholic Church, from celebrating Mass and from living in West Virginia. Bransfield had led the church there for 13 years. In November, Brennan had proposed, per Francis's demand, a specific proposal for Bransfield's restitution. Some experts say the restitution package was a first for the bishop. Bransfield called for his predecessor, Brennan called for his predecessor, now 76, to pay the diocese nearly $800,000, to apologize to victims, to lose his place in the diocesan cemetery, and to lose the normal bishop retirement package and instead receive a lower stipend equal to that of someone who had been a priest for 13 years. Diocesan spokesman Tim Bishop on Monday referred the Washington Post to a July 28th letter Brennan wrote to the diocese. The letter only briefly mentioned Bransfield, saying that neither Brennan nor the Papal Nuncio, the Vatican's ambassador to the United States, had heard back from Rome since November on the plan of amends I submitted. It wasn't immediately clear whether Brennan in the Metro News report is saying Rome needs to approve of Brennan's plan, Bransfield's response, or both. Bransfield declined comment Monday, and his lawyers did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The Post in 2019 obtained an internal church investigation that found Bransfield, as bishop in one of the country's poorest states, spent millions of dollars of diocesan money on chartered jets, lavish furnishings at his official residence, and nearly 600 cash gifts to fellow clergymen. The Post also found that $21 million was moved from a church-owned hospital in Wheeling, West Virginia, to be used at Bransfield's discretion. The money was moved into the Bishop's Fund, a charity Bransfield created with the stated purpose of helping residents of West Virginia, tax filings showed. The Post published the internal report in December. Metro News quoted Brennan last week as saying Bransfield would not come up with his own plan and did not admit to his actions. Brennan previously told Metro News that Bransfield told him he did not know who he needed to apologize to. Francis was the one who initially called for Bransfield to make amends, Brennan said to Metro News. I wasn't sent in to demand that. They demanded that. They asked me to work with him, and let me tell you, that was not easy to do, Brennan said. Bransfield has denied wrongdoing, saying that his staff in Wheeling was responsible for diocesan finances and which accounts checks came from. He has told the Post that he thinks he greatly improved the financial health of the diocese during his tenure, and that gifts and lavish perks were within church culture norm. He has denied the claims of seminarians and priests who said he sexually harassed them. We'll head back to Religion News Service now in an article published on August 11th following the selection of Kamala Harris as the running mate for Joe Biden. And this is by Yonat Shimron. And the title of this article is Five Faith Facts About Biden's VP Choice Kamala Harris, a Black Baptist with Hindu Family. Few, if any, vice presidential candidates have had as much exposure to the world's religions as Kamala Harris, the 55-year-old senator from California whom Joe Biden just picked as his running mate. Harris's ethnic, racial, and cultural biography represents a slice of the U.S. population that is becoming ascendant, but that has never been represented in the nation's second highest office. Here are five faith facts about Harris. Number one, she was raised on Hinduism and Christianity. Her mother, Shyamala Gopalan, was from Chennai, India. Her father, Donald Harris, from Jamaica. The two met as graduate students at the University of California, Berkeley. Her name, Kamala, means lotus in Sanskrit and is another name for the Hindu goddess Lakshmi. She visited India multiple times as a girl and got to know her relatives there. But because her parents divorced when she was seven, she also grew up in Oakland and Berkeley, attending predominantly black churches. Her downstairs neighbor, Regina Shelton, often took Kamala and her sister, Maya, to Oakland's 23rd Avenue Church of God in Oakland. Harris now considers herself a Black Baptist. Number two, she is married to a Jewish man. Harris met her husband, Los Angeles lawyer Douglas Emhoff, on a blind date in San Francisco. They married in 2014. At their wedding, the couple smashed a glass to honor Emhoff's upbringing, a traditional Jewish wedding custom. It was Harris's first marriage and his second. An article in the Jewish press described her imitation of her Jewish mother-in-law, Barbara Emhoff, as worthy of an Oscar. Number three, she was criticized for not proactively assisting in civil cases against Catholic clergy sex abuse during the years she served as a prosecutor. After graduating from the University of California Hastings College of the Law, Harris specialized in prosecuting sex crimes and child exploitation as a young prosecutor. But two investigations by The Intercept and the Associated Press found that Harris was consistently silent on the Catholic Church's abuse scandal, first as San Francisco District Attorney and later as California's Attorney General. Survivors of sex abuse at the hands of priests say she resisted informal requests to help them with their cases and refused to release church records on abuse of priests that had been gathered by her predecessor, Terrence Hallinan. Number four, as Attorney General, Harris filed a brief with the U.S. Supreme Court asking it to refuse Hobby Lobby's request to deny women health care coverage for contraception because of the craft store chain owner's religious beliefs. In her 2014 brief, supported by 15 states and the city of Washington, D.C., Harris wrote that if Hobby Lobby were allowed to withhold birth control coverage on religious grounds, it might lead other corporations to demand similar exemptions from the nation's civil rights laws. In the landmark decision, the Supreme Court ruled that family-owned corporations can't be forced to pay for insurance coverage for contraception under the Affordable Care Act if it offends their religious beliefs. Later, as a U.S. senator, Harris co-sponsored a congressional bill to weaken the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to ensure it is not used to permit discrimination in the name of religion. The measure, called the Do No Harm Act, was first introduced in 2017 and again in 2019. RFRA originally passed in 1993 to prevent the government from substantially burdening a person's exercise of religion. Do No Harm's backers believe that RFRA should not be interpreted to authorize an exemption from generally applicable law. Had it passed, it would have ensured that religious employers could not deny health care coverage for employees or claim exemptions to civil rights laws. Number 5. When running for president last year, she often used the New Testament parable of the Good Samaritan. Jesus tells the parable about an outsider who helps a man beaten and left on the side of the road. Harris has said it has helped her clarify who one's neighbor is. Neighbor is not about having the same zip code, Harris said at a Poor People's Campaign Forum last year. What we learn about in that parable is that neighbor is someone you're walking by on the street. Neighbor is about understanding and living in service of others, that we are all each other's brothers and sisters. In other speeches, Harris has invoked liberation theology, the strain of Christian thought that emphasizes social concern for the poor and political liberation for oppressed peoples. Justice is on the ballot, Harris said at an event hosted by the Iowa Democratic Party last year. Economic justice is on the ballot. Healthcare justice is on the ballot. Education justice is on the ballot. Reproductive justice is on the ballot. Justice for children is on the ballot. Here's the bottom line, Iowa. I do believe that when we overcome these injustices, we will unlock the promise of America and the potential of the American people. We'll wrap up this week on Religion in the News with a couple of short articles. The first one, a commentary from the Salt Lake Tribune entitled, Freedom of Religion Doesn't Mean Freedom from Mask Mandates. And this is written by John E. Finn of Wesleyan University. Mask mandates do not violate the First Amendment's protections for freedom of speech, assembly, and association, as I wrote recently in a story that examined constitution-based objections to mask-wearing requirements. But a recent lawsuit filed in Florida, Tillis v. Manatee County, raises a different question. Do mask mandates violate the free exercise of religion? The answer is no. No matter what you believe or why you believe it, the First Amendment guarantee of freedom of religion, known as the Free Exercise Clause, does not exempt you from a public health requirement to wear a mask. In the Tillis case, the claim is that a mask mandate should not apply within churches, synagogues, and other houses of worship because it interferes with the ability to pray. The lawsuit, filed by the Reverend Joel D. Tillis and Florida State Representative Anthony Sabatini as Tillis's attorney, challenges a mandate imposed by Manatee County. The plaintiffs allege that masks make it more difficult to preach and for members of the choir to sing. Courts typically assess freedom of religion claims based on the Free Exercise Clause, using what constitutional lawyers call the rational basis test. As Justice Antonin Scalia wrote for the Supreme Court in the 1983 case of Employment Division v. Smith, laws that do not intend to single out religion but instead apply widely must be rationally related to a legitimate governmental interest to be constitutional. By design, that test is highly deferential to the government. Only rarely will the government fail to pass it. If we assume that a mask mandate applies to everyone and is not intended to single out religion or people of faith, then the government's undoubted interest in protecting public health will almost certainly satisfy the rational basis test. Alternatively, many states, including Florida, have passed Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, which typically require courts to use a much more rigorous standard of review, a standard called strict scrutiny in free exercise cases. Under this test, a court will require the law to further a compelling governmental interest, and the law must be narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. This is a much more demanding test than the rational basis test, and puts a much higher burden on the government to justify the law in question. Which test a court will use thus depends on whether the claim is that a mask mandate violates the First Amendment to the federal Constitution or that it violates a state constitutional guarantee of religious freedom. The lawsuit filed by the Reverend Tillis, for example, complains only that the mandate violates the Florida Constitution. Which test applies also depends on what the lawsuit claims. If the suit alleges a violation of the First Amendment, a court will ask if the mandate has a rational basis. If the lawsuit alleges a violation of a state Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a court will ask if the law is narrowly tailored to further a compelling state interest. As I wrote previously, courts are very likely to rule that mask mandates do advance a compelling state interest, the protection of public health, and do so in a way that minimizes the restriction on the constitutional right involved, whether of speech or of religion. Face masks, for example, are far less burdensome than stay-at-home orders or quarantines. Mask mandates that are carefully drafted and that indicate where and when the mandate does not apply, such as exemptions for situations where masking is impossible, like swimming or eating in dental offices, are very likely to pass strict scrutiny. Consequently, whether a court uses the more demanding strict scrutiny test or the less demanding rational basis test, the result will probably be the same. In the end, religious objections to masks are no more a constitutional obstacle to mask requirements than are objections grounded in free speech. And finally, a news brief from the Associated Press, the headline, Pope Decries Pandemic's Culture of Individuality. And this is Dateline Vatican City. Pope Francis has denounced a culture of individuality revealed by the pandemic, which has sacrificed the care of the weakest members of society. Francis, speaking at his Wednesday audience, called on the faithful to overcome our personal and collective individualism as experts work to find a cure for the coronavirus, which hit us all indiscriminately. The pontiff said that the pandemic has revealed how vulnerable and interconnected we all are, while also making us more aware of the spread within our societies of a false individualistic way of thinking, one that rejects human dignity and relationships, views persons as consumer goods, and creates a throwaway culture. He called on people to look with care at our brothers and sisters, especially those who suffer, and recognize human dignity in every person, whatever their race, language, or condition. Well, we've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We certainly do appreciate you tuning in and hope you enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this program and its contents are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that you can take Religion in the News with you anywhere you go by taking us as a podcast. You can visit our website at www.ncreadingservice.org, click on the Listen tab, and then under Podcasts, select Religion in the News. We post our weekly episodes every week, so if you missed an episode, you can catch up on archived episodes there as well. If you find an article that you'd like to see featured on an upcoming episode of Religion in the News, feel free to send it our way. Give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. We'll talk to you next time. I hope you have a safe, healthy, and wonderful week, and we'll see you next time on Religion in the News.